from PowerlineBlog.com. This is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierenkopf, and Stephen Hayward.
Well, hey, everybody out there in Powerland. It's John Hinderacher and I coming at you today with one of our episodic updates on the Powerline show, which we have made a New Year's resolution to revive and come out with more frequently. And, John, you know, I'm out here in California where we had a little rain today, but I'm still in my shirt sleeve. So my condolences to you there shivering in Minnesota.
Yeah. Well, when I woke up in South Dakota on Sunday morning, the temperature was 25 degrees below zero. That's cold, even by our standards. Before we jump into the news of the day, though, Steve, let me just give you a quick warning. If you hear screams suddenly coming in the background, that would be my wife, or it might possibly be me. We have a bat loose in the house, have not been able to find it so that the exterminator can get rid of it. So at any moment, it might fly by. And if so, we might have a brief interruption.
well, that will scotch my otherwise go-to theory, which would be somebody open the door and let in some air.
Well, one of the problems, of course, is that the bat does not want to go outdoors. It's like five below. Bats aren't stupid, you know. Yeah, right. So he's going to stay in the house as long as he possibly can.
Right. Well, let's turn to the news of the day, which is Al Franken went through with his resignation from the Senate. I was, you know, 80% certain he was going to back out of it under some, you know, Torricelli type pretext. But he's gone through with it. And so, first of all, tell us a little bit about his replacement. Well, three things, I think. First of all, his replacement is the Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith. Second, it means we're going to have two Senate elections this year in Minnesota, as well as a governor's race. And three, what does this all mean for the politics of Minnesota? I mean, I think I'll tee you up this way, that a lot of people around the country don't realize that Minnesota very nearly went for Trump in the election in 2016. It's trending purple and maybe, especially if you have something to do with it, may become a red state. So decode what's happening in Minnesota for us.
Well, Steve, as you know, my think tank, Center of the American Experiment, is working around the clock to make Minnesota a conservative state, and we're making a lot of progress. As you said, in 2016, Trump only lost Minnesota by a point and a half. I mean, it was close. A lot of people said if he had visited the state twice instead of once, he might have carried it. In the fall of this year, Minnesota is going to be the eye of the hurricane. I mean, the eyes of the nation will be upon us because, as you said, we will have two Senate races. Both of our Senate seats will be up. In addition to that, the governor's race will be important, certainly locally. But beyond that, Steve, something that a lot of people haven't been thinking about, you know, the Democrats think that they may be able to take the House this year, and they may very well be right. But in that context, any opportunities for Republican pickups are going to be huge. If it's coming down to the wire on control of the House, if the GOP can pick up 3, 4, 5, 6 Democratic seats, that's probably going to stem the tide. Well, we have three opportunities for Republican pickups here in Minnesota. The 1st District, the 7th District, and the 8th District are three of the four rural districts in America still represented by Democrats. All three could go Republican this year. So there's going to be more money flowing into this state than you can imagine.
Yeah, I think Trump won those districts, right? All three of them?
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. The 7th, which is the one least likely to be carried this year by a Republican, I think he won it by, I don't know, 25 points or something. The 8th, he carried by 16 points. Huh. I mean, these seats are very much in play.
Now, the other odd thing about it's not unusual for a senator to leave office and be replaced by an appointment by the governor. But in this case, you took the lieutenant governor, which opened up the lieutenant governorship, which normally, as I understand it from Scott Johnson's post today on Powerline, it would be the president pro tem of the Senate, who is a Republican.
Yeah.
But the Senate's so close that it might tip the Senate back to the Democrats. And so it sounds like total confusion now.
It's typically crazy Minnesota politics. That's exactly right. So let's go back to square
first,
one.
Let me interrupt and have you remind people that Republicans have a majority in the state legislature right now in Minnesota, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. The Republicans control the Minnesota House and have for a little while, relatively comfortably, and they control the Senate as well. And that's new as of 2016. First time since we went to partisan elections in the Senate 40 or 50 years ago that the Republicans have controlled it by one vote. And the majority leader of the Senate and the president pro tem is, I believe, Michelle Fischbach is her name, and she's a Republican. So constitutionally, with Governor Mark Dayton, a Democrat, appointing his lieutenant governor, Tina Smith, obviously also a Democrat, to this Senate seat, that means that the majority leader of the Senate now becomes the lieutenant governor. And the Democrats, of course, are claiming that she has to forfeit her seat in the Senate. There has to be a special election. And if they win it, they take control of the Minnesota Senate. There is a 19th century, if I remember correctly, Minnesota Supreme Court decision that seems to say that you can be both the president of the Senate and the lieutenant governor. And Republicans are relying on that decision. I've read it, Steve. I can't make head or tail out of it. I cannot read that decision. And the circumstances were different. I can't understand the court's logic. I have no idea whether today's Supreme Court would decide that issue the same way or not.
Well, you know, I don't know. I've not read the Minnesota Constitution. They're usually longer documents, but that would not be permissible under the federal Constitution, which is quite explicit that you can't be in Congress and in the executive branch at the same time. But a lot of state constitutions are don't follow that necessarily. So who knows?
We have a constitutional provision that on simple, straightforward reading would appear to say you can't do it. And so the Republicans are relying on the Supreme Court decision. I find the Supreme Court decision to be cryptic at best. And I think it's a wide open question, you know, how that's going to turn out.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see.
And by the way, Michelle Fischbach, now the lieutenant governor, has turned down her salary as lieutenant governor.
Right.
And is going to continue to draw her very modest stipend as a member of the Minnesota Senate as a kind of a symbolic, you know, declaration that she intends to stay in the Senate. But
yeah,
how that'll play out, we don't know.
Who the heck? That's another legal question, I suppose. I don't like to be too macabre and clever about these things. But, you know, Governor Dayton has not exactly been in the best of health the last few years. And it is his last year in office. But suppose there were a sudden vacancy in the governor's office for whatever reason. And you had this ambiguity as to who the lieutenant governor is.
I don't think that's ambiguous. I think she clearly is lieutenant governor. I think what's ambiguous is, you know, can she hold her seat in the Minnesota Senate? And the short answer is she's doing it. You know, she's going to show up. She's going to vote. And if the Democrats don't like it, they're going to have to go to court and see how that plays out in a relatively short time frame.
Huh, right. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. You know, as we're getting together to talk here Wednesday evening, we've just had maybe one of the five craziest days in the whole Trump story yet. And it starts with the Michael Wolff story in New York Magazine, which, by the way, you write about this in your post, and I'm going to write something about it, too, is, I think, a crazy story and one not to be taken at face value. About Trump didn't want to win, and you know, all kinds of other, you know, wild.
Well, all this stuff that Steve Bannon supposedly has said. This thing
right.
about Trump that I wrote about on Powerline this afternoon. Trump supposedly not knowing who John Boehner was, which
right.
turns out to be a complete lie. You know, this book I think is highly suspect.
Well, my theme about this, if I find the time to pull this together, I want to do a little post about how Plutarch would write about Trump. Right? I've been recently rereading Plutarch's Lies for various classroom purposes, and Wolff's story is a typical exercise in contemporary journalism where it's full of detail and extremely light on perception and insight. It doesn't really tell us anything about Trump. It's just gossip, right? And by the way, whatever happened to the old journalistic rule of having more than one source for a fact? A lot of these recreated conversations are clearly one-source stories. And, you know,
I'm saying at least one source. I mean,
well, that's right.
A lot of journalism today doesn't appear to have any sources at all.
Well, that's right. I wasn't even going to make necessarily the speculation that some of this may be wholly invented, not necessarily by Wolf, but by the interlocutor who's passing the story along, whether they get it or not. But then Trump's response saying, you know, Bannon didn't just lose his job, he lost his mind. And all of a sudden, we have maybe a new front in the Never Trumpers. And Bannon will suddenly align himself with Bill Kristol and David Frum.
We're going to start seeing a strange new respect for Steve Bannon, who's been utterly despised on the left until today. You know, all of a sudden, he may become a kind of anti-Trump oracle.
Well, Well, we saw the same thing happen with James Comey 6 months ago, right? He was the person that Democrats blamed for Hillary losing, and suddenly he was a martyr to in excess.
And now they figured out that he gets credit for Hillary not going to prison. You know, so their feelings have gotten warmer.
Right. Well, this takes us back to something you wrote a couple days ago, that the Never Trump movement ought to be over. How did you put that? Can you recapitulate?
Yeah, the title of my post was, "It is time to pull the plug on Never Trumpism."
Yeah.
And the theme of that post, Steve, was that all of these people, and I took off from a couple of folks, including Brett Stevens in the New York Times, ticking off a whole bunch of policy positions that Donald Trump has successfully implemented and saying, I agree with all of them. And nevertheless, I wish that Hillary Clinton were president. How is that possible? And kind of a similar comment from Bill Kristol. And what I said was that, you know, there's a certain perspective from which it could be rational for a conservative to be a never Trumper. You have to believe that the tone of our politics, the style of our politics, is extremely important, and the president plays a major role in setting that tone. And you have to believe that that is so important that it outweighs all of the policy issues where we conservatives are doing battle with the liberals, and where Trump has really been quite successful. And my point was that to actually make that, you know, to balance those factors in that way, I think you have to be disconnected from reality. I think you have to be not taking seriously the possibility of North Korea bombing San Francisco or Iran dominating the Middle East. And you have to not take seriously how critically important it is that we have 3% growth or 4% growth instead of 1% GDP growth as we had under Obama, and so on. You know, the list goes on. And I think some of these people who live their lives in the op-ed pages of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, I think there's a disconnection from reality where they've really lost sight of how important these substantive issues are.
Well, yeah, I mean, the difficulty is this. I have this sympathy with, Bill Kristol's a good friend. I know David Frum. I don't know Brett Stevens at all. I agree with them about the point that, the tone and character of democratic discourse, or democratic norms, as we call them, is important. Character matters. That's what we were saying during the Clinton years when liberals were saying it didn't. On the other hand, I think the good rejoinder to this is the person who said this reminds us of the way Lincoln responded to people who saying, you've got to get rid of General Grant. He's a drunk. And what did Lincoln say? He said two things. One is, I can't spare the man. He fights. And second, remember he said, I wish I could find out what kind of whiskey he drank so I could send it to all my generals so they'd fight like him, right? Trump, you know, I think we can criticize the way Trump fights, but his disposition to do so is something we haven't seen in sufficient quantity for a very long time. Steve, Nixon, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, Steve, for liberals to start complaining about the tone of political discourse, yes, and about civility, are you kidding me?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What do they say about us every single freaking day?
Right.
You know, for
right.
years this has been going on, and now we've got somebody on the right, and I now am convinced that Trump is on the right, which was the reservation I had about him during the primary season. I didn't think he was conservative enough.
Right.
And now we have somebody on the right who actually fights back, fire with fire. If the liberals want to talk about civility, we got to wind the clock back a little bit and remind them what they've been doing.
Oh yeah. I give a whole talk about how, the first president to first Democrat to explicitly compare a Republican nominee to Hitler was Harry Truman in 1948. He said Tom Dewey was just like Hitler.
Yeah.
And Tom Dewey, of all people? I mean, he made look like Jesse Ventura or something, right? This has been a long staple of Democrats. And you can remember the way the media, the Democrats, caricatured Barry Goldwater in 1964. No, that's quite correct. They're getting what they deserve now, and they don't like it very much, which is, delicious payback, I think. The other thing that should be brought up about the Trump story today is, boy, he's really flooding the zone, because it wasn't just this Bannon and the Michael Wolff story. It's also his tweet about the size of his nuclear button.
You know, you just I confess to you, I'm getting a little, on a day like today, I'm getting a little bit of Trump fatigue too, okay? I mean, my God, it would be nice to get a little bit more back to normal. But you know, it's amazing to me how the liberals keep taking the bait. So there was a big story that the Associated Press took out today, taking off on Trump's tweet about how, hey, I got a nuclear button on my desk too, and it's a heck of a lot bigger than your button, and it works, which I thought was a perfectly apt comment by the president. And so the AP goes off of this whole long thing about how, well, there isn't actually a button on the desk in the Oval Office. There's no such button. It's like, oh, come on. My God, you know, do these people not understand? It's not just that they don't understand Twitter and, you know, what you can say in 100 or 200 characters, but I mean, my Lord.
You know, well, you never know about these things. I remember, I think George Will years ago writing that if there really was a button on the president's desk, somebody would have long ago set a coffee cup on it by mistake and blown up the world, right? But people do think this is literal. I mean, right?
And the idea that the rest of us are so stupid that we don't know how to read that tweet or read about that tweet and get the point, you know, that it's all about whether there's an actual physical button built into the desk and the oven, you know, that's just so dumb, but it is typical of the constant carping that you see from outlets like the Associated Press.
Well, it is also the whole fuss reminds me of how the media and the left reacted when Ronald Reagan made that joke warming up for a radio address in 1984, yeah, saying, you know, I've signed legislation outlawing the Soviet Union. We begin bombing in 5 minutes. And you hear a bunch of people laughing in the background. And I remember distinctly seeing Dan Rather looking all ashen, like, you know, the bombs were about to start dropping. And there had been this – you can look it up on YouTube. There was a whole bunch of stories after that about, oh, my God, the Soviet Union almost launched their missiles because of the – I mean, complete nonsense. But you go back even a little further – you know, back in the 1950s, what was the strategy, at least as the liberals put it, of the Eisenhower administration? It was brinksmanship. It was John Foster Dulles and Eisenhower threatening North Korea that if you don't end the war, we might just have to drop the big one on you. We've kind of conveniently forgotten that this is not abnormal diplomacy by any stretch of the imagination. The only thing that's novel is, you know, Trump's rather flamboyant way of doing it and the medium of Twitter.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people on the right say, oh, I wish he'd stop tweeting. You know, I did a post yesterday, as you know, Steve, about his Twitter storm. I mean, to start the new year, he obviously had been resting up, but he did like 11 tweets yesterday, some of which were non-controversial and others, of course, provoked all kinds of hysteria on the left. But you know, it's what's striking to me is that not only when President Trump, you know, tweets, not only do God knows how many people read it on Twitter. I don't know how many followers he has, but a whole lot. You know, but the liberal media will dutifully swing into action to talk about it. Yeah. I mean, they're like trained SEALs. You know, they can't resist, and he really does reach a lot of people that way.
Oh, now I'll add one last observation about this, and then we can move on to topic three. I've noticed on these tweets the last few days a near complete absence, or perhaps the complete absence, of the usual grammatical mistakes and spelling errors you see in Trump tweets. Well, I'm wondering if he's now running them past an editor. It's a fool's errand, right? Oh, I hope so, too.
It's a fool's errand
to stop him from tweeting, but I wouldn't be surprised if General Kelly has said, look, you at least need to run these through somebody who will make sure you don't embarrass yourself with another Covfefe or something, which is still my favorite.
And no one ever has figured out what the heck that was all about. And Trump doesn't drink, you know, which would be the obvious explanation for some of these things.
Right.
So, you know, yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I mean, what I was saying 6 months ago was, I mean, even your wife, you know what I mean? Just run them by Melania, just somebody you trust as a final filter before you hit that button. And you're right. Lately, we have not been seeing the kinds of grammatical or punctuation nits that used to be common.
Yeah. So topic number three is germane to the cold snap, where there are complaints about high natural gas and the fuel oil prices in the Northeast. But it brings me back to the work we did a few months ago there in Minnesota. where to bring listeners up to date who haven't followed this either on Powerline or elsewhere. I wrote a study for John's think tank, Center of the American Experiment, that concluded that especially wind energy in Minnesota should be understood as crony energy, you know, heavily subsidized, not reducing greenhouse gases. And the one that killed me the most when going through the data was discovering that when the wind isn't blowing, how does Minnesota generate its electricity to make up for the gap? They turn up their coal-fired power. To talk about an epic fail in what you say you're trying to do with your energy policy. And so what I noticed, John, is after we called it what you and I called it crony energy in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the environmentalists went nuts, right? They started the usual name-calling and foot-stamping and having a whole tantrum about the thing, which shows you that they either couldn't dispute our facts or our logic.
As usual, yeah. And just briefly, for those who haven't been reading about it on Powerline, this study showed that about $15 billion had been spent on wind turbines and transmission lines. As a result of that, the historic advantage that Minnesota had of cheap electricity, as far back as we have records, electricity in Minnesota was about 18 or 20% cheaper than the national average. In recent years, that advantage has been lost, and starting in 2017, electricity is actually more expensive in Minnesota than the national average. So we have just frittered away billions of dollars on this whole green energy policy, the only plausible point of which is to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, and it's failed. It hasn't done that. So whatever you think about global warming and carbon dioxide, you know, our paper doesn't challenge that, you know. Right. It says, fine, that was the goal, but it's failed. We spent $15 billion and we've accomplished nothing other than to make electricity more expensive. The great thing about this, Steve, is that, you know, whoever attacks green energy, right, whoever just goes right after it and attacks it and says it's bad policy and it's a failure, no one does.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And so, you know, we really stuck the pig. And the crony
there are
pig
a few people
has
who
been
do,
squealing.
Right? There are a few people besides us who do it. There's an economist in Wyoming, Jonathan Lesser, who's very good on this subject. And he's written a paper for the Manhattan Institute I recommend people in the Northeast find about New York's energy policy. And maybe we'll end with a couple of thoughts on this. You know, right now, what's the storm that's supposedly hitting the there's some funny name for the storm that's supposedly blowing in tonight. It's the bombshell something or other. We now name our winter storms as well as our tropical storms, right? But what people are noticing is people in New England are saying, wait a minute, I don't understand. We live with abundant natural gas now, and it's cheaper than ever, but our gas prices are going through the natural gas prices are going through the roof here in New England. And I suspect that there's an easy answer for why this is happening. And sometime in the next couple of days, I will compile the headlines for a post on Powerline of all the proposed pipelines for natural gas through New York State that Governor Cuomo has blocked using his powers as governor. And so, we're short of supply. And when you're short of supply, the price is going to go up. But the only reason we're short of supply is not because we don't have the gas, but it's because the governor of New York has blocked the infrastructure for it from reaching those other New England states and New York, for that matter. I certainly hope he runs for president on that record. That'd be a wonderful thing for him to try and defend for the rest of the country.
Yeah, that's so interesting, you know, the whole pipeline thing. We've got a pipeline going across northern Minnesota where what they want to do is replace an existing pipeline, which has reached the end of its useful life, with one that is brand new and won't leak. Right. Well, who would be opposed to that? No.
Oh, I can guess who's opposed to it.
But you're right. The usual suspects are all opposed to it. And, you know, they're staging sit-ins and occupations and physically interfering with work. It's unbelievable. And the project is to replace an aging pipeline with a brand new one. But so there's just this irrational opposition that's causing a lot of problems.
Well, as our pal Jonah Goldberg likes to say, we live in a stupid time. Well, I tell you what, John, I think that's probably enough for today. I'm going to let you go back to trying to chase a bat around your house, and I'm going to go barbecue out here on the left coast.
All right. Well, we're not doing any. Our barbecue has been – our grill has been shut down for the season, Steve.
I'll bet.
No one's going out on our deck for the next few months. It's all
okay.
It's a little chilly out there, so we'll be back soon. This is fun, and we're going to be back on the podcasting trail.
Good. Okay. Take care, John.
Bye-bye.
Powerline is a production of PowerlineBlog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com. Ricochet. Join the conversation.